You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've just been listening to the Hot Texas Swing Band doing their rendition of Hot Texas.
And we're so delighted to have you with us tonight. This is our celebration of our second anniversary, so we're going into our third year. And thank you so much if you've been traveling along with us all this time or you're joining us tonight for the first time. We really thank you for giving us your time and your attention.
Honey,
who are our guests tonight?
Special guests. We have Henry Park, film editor, True West Magazine. We go on the first Thursday every month. Our special guest tonight, Chris Enns. We're going to talk about her book, The Doctor Was a Woman.
So, hello, everybody.
Welcome,
hello.
Folks.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. And you've been with us from the beginning, Henry.
Yes.
And we're coast to coast tonight. Henry, where are you?
I'm in Brooklyn, New York. No one knows why.
And Chris, where are you?
I'm in Northern California between Lake Tahoe and Sacramento.
Yeah, so we are covering the country. That we're going to start a little bit with Henry. The first Thursday of every month, Henry joins us and he loves to just stay on for the show. So he'll be with us for the whole show, but he's going to give us a little bit of what's going on, Henry, in Western film and TV. What's happening?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm happy to say that this is an all good news report. Great news for the entire film and TV industry. On Saturday night, Teamsters Local 399 reached a tentative agreement with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers. So there will be no Teamsters strike. Even though the Writers Guild and Screen Actors Guild and IATSE had negotiated new contracts months ago, film and TV production had been very slow to restart because the industry was afraid they'd gear up and then the Teamsters would strike. But now that won't happen. Interestingly, one point the producers wouldn't budge on was the Teamsters' attempt to have a one-truck, one-driver rule. I had no idea that on a movie set currently, one driver can be responsible for more than one truck.
Oh.
I don't know how he drives them. I was last on Rendezvous on July 11th, and the next day, a Santa Fe judge dismissed with prejudice, which means it cannot be refiled, the involuntary manslaughter case against Alec Baldwin in the accidental fatal shooting of cinematographer Helena Hutchins on the set of Rust.
Mm-hmm.
Due to prosecution misconduct over withholding bullet evidence from the defense. Actors have never been held responsible for handling of firearms on a set. It has always been the responsibility of the armorer, and Western armorers in particular have had an exemplary record of safety for over a century. Now, of course, in the Western world, for a month, the big story has been Kevin Costner's Horizon Part 1, an American saga, which received tremendously enthusiastic response at the Cannes Film Festival, but had very disappointed box office receipts, which, of course, puts parts 2, 3, and 4 in jeopardy. Have you folks had a chance to see it?
We still haven't. You know,
no,
after you were on with us, I got bronchitis, and I laid low. We had planned to get out that very next week while it was still in the cinema, you know, in the theaters to see it, because both you and Michael Blake, who had been the guest that same night, had one of you had already seen it, or had you both? Anyway,
no,
you
both
had
seen it then, yes.
Yeah, and you were, you know,
you
thumbs up.
Good film,
yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah.
we were ready to go, but we didn't get there. Chris, have you seen it?
I have not, but I understand that I think it's streaming right now. I think you could go on and find it and look at it. And I have not done it. I've been working on a couple of new books and just haven't had time for that. Yeah. But I'm going to have to make time.
Yeah, I think streaming will be the option. I just know that everything we knew from the photography, you know, that this was one you just want to see on the big screen. But we do want to see it. So that's probably what we'll do. We'll stream. Yeah.
And just if anyone is looking for it, it's available on Amazon Prime, Fandango, Apple TV, and Google Play Movies for $20, which is more than I would pay to see it if I was in the movie. But that's me.
But we could both be, you know, we don't have to buy an individual ticket. However many people you can get in the room can see it, right?
Well, that's true. Yeah, do it like the wrestling matches that they charge a fortune for, but you get all your friends there and a lot of barbecue to see it. Yeah. Anyway, and there is some good news beyond that, is that Horizon Part 2 will premiere on September 7th at the Venice Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And Costner said in a statement, quote, "The fact that now they have decided to show Chapter 1 earlier in the day and then the world premiere of Chapter 2 that evening shows not only their belief in how the two films work together, but their support of a director's vision," unquote.
Yeah.
And there's a new Western from Lionsgate to look forward to. On Friday, September 6th, The Thicket opens in theaters. A young man's sister has been kidnapped by a villain known as Cutthroat Bob, played by Juliette Lewis. That's right, she's Bob. And he hires a famous bounty hunter, Reginald Jones, played by Peter Dinklage, to get her back. The current True West has my article on the 75th anniversary of She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and the current Henry's Western Roundup features my write-up of the new INSP series, Blue Ridge, and my interview with the Night They Came Home director, Paul Volk. That's a film about the Rufus Bug Gang. And, yes, thank you. There's my stuff. And in case you're one of those people who have been on the fence about buying my book, The Greatest Westerns Ever Made and the People Who Made Them, sorry, also known as this, to push you over the edge, my friends at INSPTV have posted an exclusive excerpt on their blog, which is my Western career interview with the great Robert Duvall. And you can read all about this and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Henry, we always are so delighted to have you with us. And I know that we had a little technical challenge in the beginning, but you just rose to the occasion, and it is live radio for any of you watching or listening. We don't go back and edit. It's live. So that's one of the things that's kind of fun about the show. All right. So Chris, Jim has a little something you're going to say about Chris, don't you?
I do. I thought it was an article in here in the mag.
It's, well, yes.
You have to worry about...
You're in both issues of True West, as I'm sure you know, Chris.
For that one you wrote on
this Tilbert. One. Oh, well, that's okay. So this issue of True West magazine featured an article about the book we're going to be talking about tonight, and the first book we're going to be talking about tonight, and then the most recent issue, the book we're going to talk about later tonight. And there's a fabulous article that you wrote right here in this magazine. So
there's a lot in this magazine.
I know. So do you want to say a little something about Chris? And then
we have a bio.
Okay.
We have a bio. Chris Enns is a New York Times bestselling author who has been writing about women in the Old West for more than 38 years. She has penned more than 50 published books on the subject. An acclaimed author, she has received multiple awards. Tonight, we'll be taking an in-depth look at her recently published book, The Doctor Was a Woman, Stories of the First Female Physicians on the Frontier. Welcome, Chris.
Well, thank you both so very much for letting me come on and be a part of the broadcast. And congratulations to Jim and Bobby and for Henry for your 2 years plus going with the show. Thank you again.
Yeah, delighted to have you back with us. Before we talk about the book, we want to talk about the Will Rogers Medallion Awards and the organization and what's coming up. You are the executive director. So tell us about the Will Rogers Awards. Medallion.
Well, the Will Rogers Award has been around for more than 20 years, and we have been based in Fort Worth, Texas for so many years, but as of 2025, we are now teamed up with the Will Rogers Memorial Museum, and our everything that we do is going to be based in Claremore, Oklahoma. We recognize some of the great works written about the American West, holding to the traditions of and values of Will Rogers. And we've been able to celebrate some really amazing authors. And we're just so pleased to be a part of the folks at the Claremore Museum. And it's going to be a big event. 2025, next year, is when we'll be there first. But in 2026, we will have the first ever writers conference at the museum. And we've got amazing authors that are going to be a part of it, including Pulitzer Prize winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin. And at the end of the program, we will be serenaded by none other than country Western Grammy Award winning artist Clint Black. So
that's so exciting. We have it on our calendar. And of course, this year you're in Fort Worth, but it's in October. And I think the 18th and 19th.
18th and 19th. We always hold it in October. Now, next year, it'll be late in the month that we'll be holding the program, because we want it to coincide with Will Rogers' birthday. So everything will coincide with the celebration of Will Rogers. And it's just fitting that we are at that location where, you know, he was born, and he's also buried at the museum. So we're just really pleased. Yeah. And, you know, I want to mention, too, that the convention or the conference that we will have in 2026 is going to be free to any Western author who would like to go.
It's fabulous.
No charge for the conference.
That's really fabulous. And I know on the website, it's a great website, there's the announcement that for those who want to submit entries for 2025, that opens November 1st
right.
of 2024.
That is correct. And can you imagine? That's just a few months away.
I mean,
that's crazy. Yeah. That's crazy that November is just a few months away. So yeah, get ready to submit your work. I mean, we had over 195 entries this past year. And we're just really pleased at the growth and the people who want to participate. Last year, Craig Johnson was a big part of what we did. And actually, he's always been a big part of what we've done. This year, I'm very excited because Barry Corbin is going to be with us.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, that's wonderful. I know, we've been watching. We finally found Northern Exposure back available, and I've been binge watching.
Good show.
It was a wonderful show.
Yeah.
Well, that is terrific. Thank you for sharing that information. We have so much to cover tonight. I had to keep an outline in order to keep myself on track. We are going to take a very short break. We're going to tell you a little bit about where all of the books of most all of the guests that we have on Rendezvous with a Writer, where you can get those books. And then when we come back, we are going to be absolutely in-depth talking about her newest book, The Doctor Was a Woman. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shops Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guests tonight, Henry Park and Chris Enns. We're just about ready to talk about Chris Enns' book, The Doctor Was a Woman, about doctors.
Stories of the first female physicians on the frontier. I almost have it memorized, Chris. I had to write that title out a whole bunch of times.
I know. Try to say that really fast three times. Yeah.
I can't say it fast or slow three times.
Well, we have to tell you that, of course, as always, we both read the book cover to cover and couldn't put it down. These stories on the individual women that you profile are absolutely fascinating, highly readable, so engaging, so much that we didn't know, which is what we're going to be talking somewhat about. And congratulations. Mm-hmm. This is a very important book, and it really brings to light, again, stories that really haven't seen the light of day till now.
Well, I enjoy being able to get in and take a look at what women did outside of the traditional ideas of what women of the American frontier were all about, which were generally they fall into two categories. They're either Miss Kitty from Dodge City or Laura Ingalls from Little House on the Prairie. People don't think women did much more than that. And so it's always a joy to be able to get in and do some research about these amazing women. And that's why I enjoyed writing about women physicians of the early frontier. When people were on the wagon trains coming west, there were no physicians with them for the most part. And so they subscribed to what we know was granny remedies. And some of those granny remedies were ridiculous. Some of them made sense, but some of them were absolutely ridiculous. They believed that owl broth cured the whooping cough. They believed that onions boiled in molasses were good as a laxative. They believed that using a salve or lard and brimstone was good for an itch. And some of these things, as I said, those made no sense. But the things that did make sense were using the mold from cheese to be placed on a cut or any kind of a deep wound. And that makes sense because there's some penicillin property in the mold. So that makes sense. The women were the ones who administered some of these granny remedies. And, you know, as they were traveling along the frontier and the wagon trains, they were sought after to administer some of these, some of the sillier granny remedies, but also some of the ones that did definitely make sense. And so just from there, I kind of thought, well, there's got to be women who wanted to pursue medicine because they got a taste of it on the way west and liked it. And so there was got to be some that really wanted to pursue medicine, not just midwifery, but really get in there and become doctors.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the, were you ready?
I was just going to say, these women doctors met a lot of resistance. Yeah. And I was thinking, I was starting to hold up your book because we have this picture of obviously a university type of setting, and we're teaching medicine, and I don't see any guys in there at all. So this must have been the only school that allowed women in.
Well, there were a couple of women's schools in the Pennsylvania area, but there was one in Ohio, too, that was just for women. And it was important that women had their own schools to go to. They tried to get into schools that were that had men, such as Harvard in 1850. Some of the women started tried to apply and did get in. A couple of them did get into Harvard to study medicine, but the men were absolutely outraged and said that any woman who deemed themselves so unfeminine as to pursue such a career, that they needed to have a curtain to separate them from any of the women, so they wouldn't be tempted to even look over at these vile human beings.
The obstacles. And there was some challenges. Well, all the challenges were unfamiliar to us, but even that women couldn't purchase. There were certain supplies and medicines and things that they were not, I think, allowed to have. Is that right?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the women who were studying medicine in the East, if there wasn't any way that you were really going to have a successful practice in the East, and that was just because you're a woman. So that just, they had different morals then. That's what made the West so wonderful. Uh-huh. You could go west of the Mississippi and you could be who you wanted to be. It would be a struggle, certainly for these female physicians, it was a struggle. But you could go west, and a lot of these women who studied medicine and got a degree decided that they would travel west to set up a practice, and they believed that they had a good opportunity of being able to have people come to see them because doctors were very few and far in between, 75 miles between doctors sometimes, if not more. And so these women thought they had a chance, but indeed when they got west, they found out that they had major obstacles of going to go through. And one of those hurdles were they were not allowed to purchase any medical supplies. So they had to be very creative about what they used to set a bone. And they also had to be their own pharmacist. So they weren't going to be able to get anybody to sell them any cough medicine or anything of that nature. And so they really had to be quite adept at being an all-around physician.
Did you have a question? It sounded like you had a question.
Wait a second. You know, going west in those days was a trial, a tribulation for anybody.
Yeah.
Even if you were well-prepared and had money and knew what you were doing, let alone somebody that, you know, some of these ladies hardly had any money, and they were in a field that nobody wanted them to be in. They're going west to a place they've never been. You know, that's kind of scary, isn't it?
And I think a lot of them were single. They really didn't yet have families or spouses. They were just, I got this.
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of the women who did come west to be physicians were not married. The ones that were married were the women that were in Mormon families. Mm. Generally, you had a big Mormon family, and it was important to be able to select one or two of the women who wanted to study medicine, and they would be sent to all women's schools to study medicine and come back with a degree. And then they would train other women from that point on. But that they were very smart. They knew that the Mormon families knew, big families, they knew they were going to have a doctor. Can't be carting people off to physicians. You needed to have one right in the family. So those women were skilled and came back and trained others. And so that was important. But women, like, for example, one of the ladies, that's one of my favorite in the book, her name is Dr. Bessie Effner. Mm-hmm. And she, in 1907, goes to a place called Carpenter, Wyoming, where, you know, there's just nothing in Carpenter, Wyoming. But she goes there hoping to be able to establish a practice. And she also has with her her nieces, because her brother and sister-in-law passed away, and she has her nieces with her. So times were tough. She was not going to be paid right away unless you get your practice established. So this poor soul comes all the way out. She came from a long line of doctors. All the men in her family had been physicians, and she wanted to be a physician, and really was the first woman in her family for generations who really aspired to be a physician. So here she is in Carpenter, Wyoming, and she sets up her little practice, and no one comes to see her until finally a gentleman knocks on her door, and he explains to her that his horse has some major issues. And she says, listen, I don't know anything about helping horses. I'm a people doctor. But the gentleman was adamant and explained to her what was wrong with the horse. And she said, well, he sounds like he has colic, but I know nothing about this. And he pleads with her to give him some medicine. She has medicine for colic, but she knows nothing about the dosage to give a horse. And so again, she tells the owner, I will give you some medicine. You'll have to up the dosage for your horse. I don't know what that would be, but my hands are clean. If something happens with the horse, this is all on you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he hurries back home. He gives the medicine to his horse. The following morning, he is at her home, knocking on her door, and he's so happy because the horse is fine. The horse is well. Medicine given to the horse, and with him in the wagon comes his entire family. Now the family can be seen because now we can trust you. We've trusted you with our livestock, which really back in the old West, trusting you with your livestock was quite
that's a big deal.
Yeah.
You didn't have your horse. You didn't have a job. Yeah. You didn't have any way to get the products that you need. So really, when you think about it, at that particular time in history, the horses had great value, great wealth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And she builds the practice that word of mouth is social media at that time.
Right.
It goes viral.
Absolutely. builds her practice. At first, she's getting paid in dollars and cents, very little of that. I mean, but what she is getting paid with is livestock, chickens, mm-hmm. jam, but it keeps her children in food. And little by little, her practice grows. But I thought that she was just amazing because she was determined. And one of the patients that she treats, a man that's thrown from the horse and his jaw is broken and he's got multiple cuts and bruises, and treating his cut and bruises were easy, but how to handle the jaw required deep thought. And so she couldn't cast or splint the break, and a bandage wasn't going to be sufficient to hold the bones in place after she reset them. So she decided the best course of action was going to be to remove one of the man's molars, which would provide space for the feeding tube to be inserted.
Very smart.
So, and this was just trial and error, what she had to do.
Yeah. So. Speaking of smart women, because now we can kind of, these stories are so fabulous. So Sophie Herzog.
Wasn't she great?
Gosh, tell us about Sophie Herzog.
Oh my gosh. Sophie and her husband were doctors in Austria, and they finally moved to New York in the late 1860s. And as I said, you could be a midwife in the East, but she wanted to be more than that. And it wasn't until after her husband, who was a very well-respected physician, it wasn't until after he passed away that she decided, I'm going to go to one of these medical schools that were just for women, and I'm going to become a physician. She does so. She has lots of children. She follows one of her daughters to Texas, to Brazoria, Texas, where she sets up her practice. And what makes Sophie so unique is that she revolutionized the way gunshot wound victims were treated. In the Old West, if you were shot, if the bullet didn't kill you, what killed you likely was the doctor probing in to pull that bullet out. You nicked major arteries, you nicked some vital organs. And so the life expectancy of someone hit by a bullet wasn't very long. But in Sophie's care, your life expectancy was extended. And her way of handling these poor gunshot wound victims who were shot below the heart and above the knee was quite unique. She would tie a rope around their legs, tie a rope around their upper torso, and tie them to a pole, very substantial pole above the hospital bed, flip them upside down, and let gravity take its course. In time, that bullet would work its way to the surface of the wound, and she would come and pluck that bullet right out.
It's astounding.
So successful, she had a necklace made of all the bullets that she had removed.
Wow.
And when she passed away, she was buried with that necklace.
Yeah. So creative.
Yeah.
So just like you were saying, so imaginative and creative. How about, Lillian Heath?
Yeah, I just love the story of Lillian Heath, too. I mean, she was a pioneer in the field of plastic surgery, not plastic surgery like we think of today, where, I want dimples put in. I don't like my chin. Lillian Heath lived in Rawlins, Wyoming, and she treated a gentleman by the name of George Webb. Rawlins, Wyoming was a railroad town. You had lots of railroad workers working there. And one particular gentleman, George Webb, was quite depressed with his life and his situation. And he decided he didn't want to live any longer. And he put his shotgun underneath his chin and fired. Now, it didn't kill him, but it did split his face apart. And Lillian Heath, Dr. Heath, was working with another physician, apprenticing at the time, a male physician, which was rare. But she was apprenticing with this male physician, and it was with this male physician that she helps George undergo 17 surgeries to put his face back together. And he was very grateful to Dr. Heath for that, because he goes on to find a will to live afterwards, and he gets married and has children, and he's forever in debt to Dr. Heath. But 17 surgeries at a time in history in the late 1890s where there was no anesthesia that we think of today. There was no way that you were going to get any real pain medicine to help you get through to the next surgery. But she did put him back together. My favorite aspects of this book is after readers get done going through these stories about these amazing women, you'll happen on to their medical papers. Dr. Lillian Heath wrote about doing these surgeries. And so that is a part of this book. After you finish reading about Dr. Heath, you can read about doing the plastic surgery. And also with Dr. Sophie Herzog, her paper is about removing bullets. So the good thing about the book, The Doctor Was a Woman, was not just is it entertaining reading, but now you can go home and perform your own surgeries. Never mind you.
Well, and there are some of those, as you say, afterwards, some of them have remedies. They share also remedies. The influenza, the terrible time with influenza, and you read what the recommendation is, and you kind of go like, okay, COVID, this is, yep, mask, and you right. know, a lot of the same things.
So many similarities.
How did you find, you're such an amazing researcher, Chris. You just, you know, you get this idea, and you just go out there, and you unearth just wonderful, wonderful stories. How did you go about finding these women and then finding enough research about them to be able to write about them?
Well, I start by going through old newspapers. And then when I happened onto some of these women and think that there's enough about them to pursue the story, I traveled to where these women were. So I went to Brazoria, Texas, to spend some time there and to learn about Dr. Herzog. And the museum there is so wonderful. And one of the women that was the director there for a while, she is in her late 80s, early 90s. And she said, I always hope to be able to write about Dr. Sophie, but I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. So here is some primary source material. Help yourself. And so I love primary source material. I don't like to have my history filtered through anybody else's thoughts. I want to put my hand on that actual material. And that was what's so great about Bessie Effner's material too. Her husband, eventually she marries, and her husband compiles a lot of the information about Dr. Effner. And so it's that material that I glean to be able to write about her. But I mean, that's what's so great about history. It just being touching, just being getting your hand inside history, holding on to it.
Mm-hmm. One of the women that you talked about when you mentioned about Mormon families early on, Emma French. What a fascinating history this gal has.
Right.
Emma French.
You know, of course, it's a Mormon family, so you may not be the first in line to be married to a particular gentleman, and she certainly wasn't. And she was married to a gentleman who was had a hand in the Mountain Meadow Massacre, and is eventually executed for his part in it. At that particular point, she decides that she doesn't necessarily want to be a part of this big group there in the Utah area. And so she goes to the Winslow, Arizona area to become a railroad surgeon. But what we don't know about, a little known fact about the Winslow, Arizona area, is how many Mormon families were there. And so she was really quite at home there, but a railroad surgeon nonetheless. A lot of these women, like Miss French, Mrs. French, was not, if you weren't able to find a place to establish your practice, what you could do was become railroad surgeons. No one really wanted that job. You would have to go up and down the line to help the gentlemen who were injured, laying tracks, surveying the land. And you went up and down the line, not necessarily in a really nice steam engine.
No.
You had to do use, yet what had to use one of those carts where you pumped to get to your
hand cart.
But they could get there. You had a couple of situations and they could get there pretty fast. They could get there faster. I think in one case, maybe a couple young men came on and helped, but she had to get there very, you know, fast. And it was very direct. And she did. She got there in the amount of time that was necessary. I don't remember what situation it was, but, you know, we see scenes in movies and things, you know, Henry, you know, about being on that, you know, on the track and never thinking about, oh, yeah, you know, would get you somewhere pretty quick.
Right. Well, I mean, that was Dr. Sophie. Sophie had two gentlemen come and get her in the middle of the night, and they helped her get, you know, do the hand cart and get there quickly. But she could have done it on her own. She was a railroad surgeon, too, for over 25 years.
Yeah.
Not only were these women tough characters, but they were tough in physical strength as well. I mean, mm-hmm. these women would have to ford rivers to get to patients. These women would have to be on the back of a horse, or some of them rode bicycles to get mm-hmm. to their patients. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were tough, tough women in so many ways. Yeah. Dr. Harriet Belcher, who was a Santa Barbara doctor in 1882, she was from New Jersey, but she was in Santa Barbara, and she would be on these buggies going over rock and you know, dusty riverbeds that didn't have anything flowing through it, and just would have to go through an awful lot of trauma to get to who she was going to help.
And
she was, you know, all of these women in the book were really pioneers in different fields. I mean, Dr. Belcher, she did, her first work was in treating women with breast cancer. And I mean, that was something that was unheard of at that particular time. But she was really quite effective at her trade. And when she diagnoses herself, she's very ill. She's ill with malaria, and she eventually passes away from complications from malaria. But she has a presence of mind to journal everything that's wrong with her. And to be able to pass it on to other doctors, to be able to help people like herself.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't just say, this is it. Forget about it. I'm just going to sit here. I'm in Santa Barbara. The ocean's very close. I'll just sit here and just live my life like that. That's mm-hmm. not what she did. You know, she mm-hmm. was a doctor right to the very end and writes about breast cancer, writes about how to treat these women, writes about how these women would come to talk with her, and they became friends with her as well, because they had other issues going on as a result, you know, emotional scars from being treated for the breast cancer. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Henry, do you have a question?
Yeah, Henry, do you have anything you want to ask or share?
I was curious. Now, I have not had a chance to read your book. And so my knowledge of doctors, women doctors of the Old West, goes all to Dr. Quinn, which, of course, is fiction. I was curious, in that show, did they get anything right?
Well, you know, I got to be on the set of Dr. Quinn a couple of times because I wrote my very first book about women physicians was called The Doctor Wore Petticoats. And so I got to be there as a consultant on the show. You know, other than the fact that you were a woman in the West trying to ply your trade, that part of it was factual. You weren't readily accepted in the community. That part of it was factual. But I, you know, I don't note that any doctor ever met anybody that looked like Scully, buckskin, who looked like that. I was always, when I was on the set, James Keach was directing, and I will tell you, he was one of the finest looking men I've ever seen in my entire life. He was gorgeous, very well dressed as a director. So that part is not true either. I don't, you know, there's so that part of it, but But the struggle was real. The struggle for women coming west to be a doctor, that part of it was real. And what you had to go through, and certainly, you know, having to find your own way to treat those patients was very real too.
Yeah.
One of the women, and you had to be creative. One of the bones that broke the most in the Old West was the femur bone. And some of the very first female physicians, one in particular that hailed from Colorado, recognized how difficult it was to be able to treat femur bones broken, because the muscles around the femur bone were so strong that that bone had a hard time setting. So this particular doctor in Colorado, Dr. Susie, would tape the inside and outside of the patient's leg with a broken femur bone, tie a rope to that leg, tie a really heavy iron to that rope that was attached to the leg, and then invert the hospital bed where the patient was, and then suddenly just drop that iron, which would instantly jerk those muscles away from that femur bone.
Wow.
That particular procedure is called Buck's extension, and we still use Buck's extension in hospitals today.
Wow.
That was invented by a woman, but that was only invented because women, like the Dr. Quinn character, had to come up with your own way of being able to treat your patients.
No problem. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've been talking with Chris Entz, the author of The Doctor Was a Woman, Stories of the First Female Physicians on the Frontier. We are going to take one more very quick break. And then when we come back, Chris, we want you to talk about the new book coming out. But we would like to thank Blue Cottage Agency. They are a sponsor for the program, and we'd like you to have a chance to hear a little bit about them. So we will be right back.
Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experienced, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest tonight, Henry Park, True West Magazine, and Chris Entz, and we're talking about her book, The Doctor Was a Woman.
And now we're shifting gears because we're looking at that clock. Oh my goodness, how fast our time is going. So you have written a book that's coming out. I'm just holding up an article that you wrote about Bill Tillman. Why don't you go ahead, Chris, and tell us a little bit, just a little bit about Mr. Tillman and what we could expect from this book.
Well, it's an unusual book because it is about frontier lawman Bill Tillman, who was just an extraordinary lawman. Bat Masterson referred to him as the finest of us all. He did get into law enforcement and he served with Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson and Charlie Bassett and a number of the really fine lawmen out of Dodge City. But he stayed in that profession from a very young age all the way up until he was 70 years old, when he was gunned down in 1924 in Cromwell, Oklahoma, by a corrupt federal agent. And so the book Tillman, the legendary lawman and the woman who inspired him, is a biography of his wife, Zoe Tillman, writing the biography of her husband, Bill Tillman. Zoe Tillman was an accomplished author, wrote some of the very first books about women of the American frontier. And she was a horseback rider, and she was a poet, and she was about 20 years younger than Tillman. And the two of them have three sons together. And when Tillman is shot down in 1924, she has $80 to her name. And she is writing for Harlow's Weekly as a literary critic and a poet. And she goes to her boss at Harlow's Weekly and says, "I don't have any money. My husband's been killed. Will you give me an advance to write the definitive biography of my husband?" And her boss says, of course, we will do that for you. It takes her 30 plus years to write this book. And as I said, it's a biography of Zoe writing about Bill. But it takes her so long because they have three sons. One of her sons is murdered. And another of their sons is arrested for murder. And so it's about her struggle dealing with that to write the story about Bill. And I was able to write this story because Zoe and Bill had three sons. Tench was their oldest son. Tench was the only one that married and had children. He had one child, Susie Tillman. Susie Tillman lives in Scottsdale, Arizona. And Susie let me go through six or seven of the original source material of Bill and Zoe's work.
Wow.
And Bill kept, those big Indian chief tablets. If he wasn't writing in one of those, Bill was just getting scratch paper and writing down. Bill took copious notes about his years in law enforcement.
Wow.
So being able to go through all of that and to read firsthand accounts of what he says happened when he arrested Bill Doolin.
Wow.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And when is this going to be available?
It comes out in October. Comes out October 1. And I'm very excited about this one. The launch is going to be at the Scottsdale Western History Museum. And the Tillman family will be there.
Wow. Wonderful, Chris. That's wonderful. So, Chris, how can people find you and follow you? Where do they go?
You can go to my website. It's chrisence.com. That's chrisence.com. You can get the books there. You can visit my website and take a look at the book trailers. I do a moment in history, little snippets called Moment in History. You can find those on my YouTube channel as well, where I talk about these amazing women in history.
Yeah.
And you can get the book on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble. And, lots of books about women.
Yeah, absolutely. And Henry, where can people follow you?
Oh, well, of course, I'm in True West Magazine every issue. I write regularly for the INSP blog about Westerns. You can find me there, Henry's Western Roundup. And as a matter of fact, the best place to get in touch with me is through the Henry's Western Roundup Facebook page. And of course, you can always run out and
get Jim, I think we might have time for one.
And this one's from the book, from one of our doctors, Bessie, and she says, as I now look back on those years of my practice on the frontier and recall to my mind the physical hardships, the professional handicaps, the hazardous drives, the long, tedious vigils, the crowded homesteader's shack, and the meager financial awards that I received, I wonder now how I had the courage to go on. But I survived. And so did my patients, in spite of all these hardships and disadvantages, all which proves, again, that man by nature is a pretty tough creature. All right.
We really enjoyed being with both of you tonight. Thank you so much for giving us your time. Really.
Thank you. And happy anniversary again. Thank you.
Next week, Howard Kaplan joins us. He's based in the Los Angeles area. His newest book is The Syrian Sunset. This is a political thriller, so ripped from the headlines, and I know he's very eager to join us next week. Jim, do you have a last-minute comment?
As always, it's always a great day out west.
Thanks so much. Keep writing, and we'll keep reading, and we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.